Millions of trade unionists stopped work for 15 minutes across Europe on Friday to say no to war in a symbolic gesture of what could happen if war starts. The former president of the Pacific Stock Exchange got arrested Friday in San Francisco, California, with 70 others saying no business as usual. Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPs, which includes about 25 retired CIA officers, are against a U.S. invasion of Iraq, and they have publicly come out against the Bush administration, saying that Bush and his cronies have released information on Iraq that meets only its ends while ignoring or withholding contrary reporting. 74 former members of Congress sent a letter to the White House Friday urging the Bush administration to hold off on any war plans with Iraq, urging the Bush administration to give UN weapons inspectors more time to do their job. 200,000 peace protesters surrounded the White House Saturday while tens of thousands marched in cities around the globe, and millions took part in a coordinated global candlelight vigil to end war last night. Does any of this have an impact? Well, Bush, Blair, and Spanish Prime Minister Aznar were isolated from world opinion on the Azores Islands in the Mid-Atlantic this week, and they still face 300 protesters as they met to decide the fate of Iraq over the weekend. And now we're hearing that the U.S. will abandon all efforts in the United Nations to seek a Security Council resolution in waging this illegal war. So with that as a backdrop, let's bring in Eric Gustafson. Eric is, as I mentioned, a Gulf War veteran and expert on U.S. foreign policy toward Iraq. In 1991, he spent 8 months in Saudi Arabia, where his unit built buildings, roads, and POW camps. Eric Gustafson has been an advocate for the Iraqi people since 1997, when he traveled to Iraq on a humanitarian mission and became a dedicated opponent of the U.S.-led economic sanctions, which have killed over 1 million civilians. Eric Gustafson is founder and executive director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, which works to shift U.S. policy and public opinion in support of the Iraqi people. He is also involved in initiating a campaign for an international treaty to ban depleted uranium weapons and help establish long-term studies on DU-affected civilian and veteran populations. Eric Gustafson served on the National Gulf War Resource Center Board from 1998 through 2000, and in September 2002, he co-founded Veterans for Common Sense, whose mission is to inject the perspective of war veterans into debates over war and national security. Eric, I want to thank you for joining me today here.
Good afternoon, Vinny.
Let's start with your reaction to the pronouncement from the Bush administration that they're going to abandon all diplomatic efforts in the United Nations. What say you?
I actually am quite alarmed by it. For the United States to go it alone against Iraq, I think is really going to create dangers for all of us and also for the world.
Eric, last Monday, Veterans for Common Sense, an organization you helped co-found, delivered a letter to President Bush questioning the wisdom of invading Iraq and requesting a meeting with him at the White House. This letter was signed by over 1,000 vets, including some very high-ranking officers, and notables such as acclaimed actor and three-time Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Kris Kristofferson. Can you summarize for us the contents of this letter and what response, if any, has come from the White House?
Well, so far we've gotten no response from the White House. I mean, one thing that I think is important to recognize, this was a letter that was initiated by the veteran community, and within 1 weekend we had 1,000 retired officers and veterans signed on, including two vice admirals, Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan and Vice Admiral Ralph Weymouth. In particular, Shanahan actually commanded the 2nd Fleet in the Atlantic. And we had Brigadier General Pat Foote, and a number of other retired officers, and as you mentioned, the former U.S. captain in the U.S. Army, Kris Kristofferson. The letter focused on our concerns about the rush to war, expressing the feelings of so many veterans that it's unwarranted and unjustified, and also expressing our concerns about what this will mean for our country in terms of national security, if there are excessive civilian deaths, and as well as what it will mean for our troops that will ultimately be doing the fighting on the battlefield.
That's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He is with the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, and he's also their executive director. He also co-founded the Veterans for Common Sense, whose mission is to inject the perspective of war veterans into debates over war and national security. Eric Gustafson, I want to ask you another question. On February 13th, 1991, two so-called smart bombs hit the Amariya bomb shelter, where over 400 Iraqi civilians, mostly children and women, were huddled. The heat from the bomb blasts sealed shut the exits, and almost everyone inside perished. Last week, during a press briefing, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld claimed that this shelter was actually a command post being used by the Iraqi military as a command and control center. What evidence exists to support this claim made by War Secretary Rumsfeld?
Well, very little. I mean, there's two principles that must be followed in the conduct of war. One is the principle of distinction, the other the principle of proportionality. Distinction means that we should only be targeting military facilities. In this case, it was a civilian bomb shelter. It was known to be so by the United States because we actually provided advisors to Iraq during the 1980s war with Iran. In addition, in terms of proportionality, if there had been some command and control function that was being served by this facility, if you had proportionately far more civilians that were taking shelter in that facility, then it should never have been on the target list.
We do have a caller on line two, David in Santa Cruz. You're on.
Hi, how's it going, B-Man?
Hi, David. How you doing today?
Hey, how's it going? And your guest? My concern is, as far as the war goes, and past conflicts as well, I don't consider this a war. I call this more of a conflict myself. And with that being said, how is the government looking at financially backing these people? Morally and financial go together like glue. And the government doesn't have a good track record in the military with benefits. I'm curious as to how the government will make the same promises stick this time that they made in the past for veterans of foreign conflict.
I think your question is important, and I am deeply concerned about what's happening right now with this administration when it comes to veteran benefits. The President and House Republicans, in their budget proposal, cut veteran benefits by $15 billion over the next 10 years. They're trying to slip this through at a time when we are about to go to war, and when the Department of Veteran Affairs will have to deal with a whole other generation of veterans that might be suffering from illnesses and injuries connected to their war service. So this is of deep concern. It doesn't appear that the administration is making the kind of political commitment in terms of taking care of our veterans, taking care of our troops, that would accompany this extremely aggressive national security policy.
And that's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He's joining us live from his office in Washington, D.C., where he is the executive director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. He's also a Gulf War veteran. Eric, in 1991, during the Gulf War, I believe only approximately 7% of the bombs dropped there were precision-guided, or what we euphemistically call now smart bombs. That figure jumped to 30% in the 1999 bombing of Yugoslavia and to nearly 70% during the Afghan air campaign late last year and late 2001. In this war coming up with Iraq, the Pentagon planners say upwards of 90% of the bombs dropped will be smart bombs. In your view, is this technology going to help minimize civilian casualties, as the war planners claim?
Well, I mean, one would hope that that's the direction things are going. Obviously, having smart bombs is and precision-guided bombs is far better than carpet bombing. However, there's a few things that I think one has to recognize. First of all, in the 1991 Gulf War, it wasn't the bombs that killed the greatest number of people. It was the social chaos that came after the war. It was the post-war conditions. Secondly, it's the targeting list. If you target civilian facilities, whether it's a smart bomb or a precision-guided bomb, it doesn't matter. If you are targeting civilian facilities, then that you are harming civilians. And we know what happened in the 91 war. Power stations were targeted and destroyed. In shutting down power stations to a city like Baghdad that has 5 million civilians, you actually make it unlivable. Water stations shut down, sewage facilities shut down. And as a result, you had waterborne diseases that became epidemic throughout the country. The post-war conditions that have dragged on for the years after the 91 war is where you saw the greatest death toll among civilians. You know, compare the thousands that died directly because of the bombs in 91 to the tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of civilians in the years that preceded.
As you're mentioning, the post-war conditions are what contributed to high numbers of civilian casualties. We also have economic sanctions that have been levied against Iraq for over 12 years. You're an expert on Iraq policy. Can you tell us about the sanctions? Why were they imposed, and what effect have they had there?
Well, they initially were imposed shortly after Iraq invaded Kuwait. This was the international community, the UN's response to Iraq's aggression. After the war, the sanctions were reinstated and connected to the ceasefire arrangement, that Iraq had to meet a number of requirements before those sanctions could be lifted. The problem is, because of the post-war conditions that Iraq was suffering, Iraq was never able to recover from the war. And in the years that preceded, by preventing Iraq from selling oil, which was the primary commodity that it depended upon to generate revenue, to, you know, pay for food, medicine, to provide for the Iraqi people. As a result of that, we saw humanitarian conditions become abysmal in Iraq. And by 1999, UNICEF held a press conference, and Carol Bellamy, the director of UNICEF, announced that because of post-war conditions and economic sanctions, that those conditions had contributed to the excess deaths of 500,000 children under the age of five. Now, this also actually undermined our policy to disarm Iraq, because it divided the Security Council. The Security Council, you know, became divided because people could not they didn't have the conscience to continue to support a policy that was claiming so many civilian lives. And so it became really challenging to continue the policy of sanctions until finally there were a number of reforms to how sanctions are applied. And we have been seeing humanitarian conditions improve in recent years because of the oil for food program, because the cap was lifted on how much oil Iraq could sell. All of those have been steps in the right direction. It hasn't eliminated the crisis in Iraq, but it certainly has improved humanitarian conditions.
That's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He is executive director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, which works to shift U.S. policy and public opinion in support of the Iraqi people. He's also a Gulf War veteran and an expert on U.S. policy toward Iraq. And Eric Gustafson is joining us by telephone from his office in Washington, D.C. Today we're hearing pronouncements from the United States and their three allies, Britain, Spain, and Bulgaria, that they're going to abandon U.N. efforts to halt a war, essentially. And the United States is basically going it alone, in my opinion, under the guise that UN Resolution 1441 will authorize a U.S. strike. Is this? Have you been able to review the Resolution 1441, and do you believe that the U.S. has the authority to wage war in Iraq?
No, I don't. 1441 is very clear. It establishes the grounds that Iraq must abide by in order to be disarmed. And I think it's unfortunate. I mean, let's go back to what just recently happened in the past months. The president made the right decision in going to the United Nations, and he really urged the UN to pass a resolution to be united behind seeing that Iraq is disarmed. We got that. In November, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 1441, and the vote at the council was unanimous. So the president, the administration, did indeed unite the world to see Iraq disarmed. When that resolution passed, the U.S. Ambassador Negroponte made it very clear that there were no automatic triggers in that resolution. And yet now we see the United States claiming that indeed 1441 is a trigger for war, which goes against what the United States had said when the resolution was passed.
Now, also, in addition to Resolution 1441, the Bush administration is claiming that the U.S. Congress ceded authority to the president to declare war back in October of 2002 when Congress passed a resolution, or what is it exactly?
The war resolution.
Authorization of use of military force. What is your take on that?
Again, if you go back to the vote in Congress in October, members of Congress in their floor speeches, in speech after speech, made it very clear that their support in providing the president with authorization to go to war was intended to strengthen his hand to negotiate a tough new resolution at the UN. That's what we got. We got 1441 at the UN, a tough new resolution, and with tough inspections, we can see Iraq disarmed without the loss of a single life. In addition, members of Congress, including Republicans like Representative Hyde, who is the chair of the House International Relations Committee, made it very clear that his vote and his support for the president's war resolution should not be interpreted as an endorsement for preemptive war. And yet now what we find ourselves, at this moment, is that we're on the brink of a preemptive war against Iraq. It's not difficult to understand why the UN Security Council has been deeply troubled by the push from the U.S. administration to pass an endorsement and authorization for a preemptive war. This goes directly against the very principles and the charter that the United Nations was founded upon, and I fear it will actually make the world an unsafe place because it repudiates an international order that has been a longstanding American tradition and commitment that has served us well in keeping the world safe.
That's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He is the executive director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center in Washington, D.C., which works to shift U.S. policy and public opinion in support of the Iraqi people. He's also a co-founder of Veterans for Common Sense and a Gulf War veteran himself. Eric Gustafson, let's talk a little bit about the Gulf War. You're a Gulf War vet. As you're saying, the stated goal here in this new war is preemptive strike against Iraq because the Bush administration claims that they possess biological, chemical, and possibly nuclear weapons, and they pose a grave danger to the peace and security of the world order. In 1991, we had a war with Iraq where there was an opportunity to take out this dictator, Saddam Hussein. Why did we let it go for so long? Why did we leave him in power?
Well, I think the previous president, President Bush, did adhere to the United Nations process, did adhere to UN resolutions, and it was very clear Iraq had to withdraw, and if not, then we would go to war and force Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. I can tell you, as a Gulf War veteran, when my unit deployed, we felt that we had the support of the American people, we had the support of the world, the United Nations, we were part of a very strong coalition of 30 allies. This time, there's no sense of justice. There's not that sense that this is the right war and the right time. I've been talking with men and women who are active in the service right now, and they tell me, there's no sense of justice. You know what we're calling this? Operation Just Us. That's the feeling from Kuwait. And some of your listeners might have heard recently, I know 60 Minutes reported from Kuwait, being able to talk directly with men and women who are actively serving today, and they will express those concerns. One private on 60 Minutes just a week ago said on national television that his greatest fear is not chemical weapons. His greatest fear is that people above him will place him in a situation that he will not be able to get out of and when it's not necessary. It's one thing if there's a national emergency, if there's a direct threat to our country, then yes, the risks are worth it. But in this case, the fear is that we are sending, young American GIs, hundreds of thousands, into an invasion of Iraq, putting them in harm's way when it is completely unnecessary.
We've got a couple callers lined up. We got Bruce in Santa Cruz calling in on a cell phone with a comment about 1991 truce. Bruce, you're on the air. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. Hey, I'll tell you what, I've got a real problem with you folks, and the problem is this. In 1991, U.S. troops were 25 miles outside of Baghdad. At that point, Saddam Hussein cried uncle. We stopped the fighting. We stopped the killing. We stopped killing their soldiers. And it was based on Saddam's and his government signing an agreement that he would fulfill certain obligations. Now, how is it possible for the UN ever again to negotiate a truce to stop a war, to stop the bloodshed, if they are unable to enforce their own resolutions and the truce that they already signed?
Thanks for your call, Bruce. Eric, do you want to handle that one?
Certainly. First of all, Bruce has his facts wrong, but it's not surprising because, unfortunately, given the talking points that are repeated over and over again by, well, primarily the right wing that has been aggressively pushing a war with Iraq for years now, it's not surprising, and I think it's unfortunate. It's done a complete disservice to the debate. What happened back in 1991, the ceasefire was a ceasefire, period. The resolution was a resolution at the Security Council. So it was not, it wasn't something that was negotiated with Saddam. It was something that was decided by the Security Council. And what we saw in the years afterwards, despite problems in terms of Iraq's full cooperation, was that despite that, the weapons inspectors, at the time they were called UNSCOM, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, was incredibly effective in dismantling Iraq's nuclear program. It discovered that Iraq did indeed have a biological program. It also destroyed the facilities that were part of the biological and chemical weapons programs. So we found that even without full cooperation, it was extremely effective. What we've been seeing in recent months with these tough new inspections as a result of this partnership between the Bush administration and the UN has been even more aggressive and more effective in disarming Iraq. And we're seeing far more cooperation than we ever saw in the 1990s. You know, President Clinton really didn't give very much attention to U.S. policy toward Iraq. With this administration, we have seen tremendous amount of attention given to it. And the president has been very effective in uniting the world to see Iraq disarmed, getting these tough new inspections into Iraq. And we're seeing results, the destruction of the Al-Samud missiles that were underway. Mm-hmm. You know, further discoveries in terms of other related programs. And we're seeing full compliance when it comes to gaining access to the most sensitive facilities throughout Iraq. We're not seeing the games that were played in the 1990s when the Clinton administration just could not unite the council. This time with the United Council, we're seeing Saddam being compelled to disarm, and that is far more effective and far more safe than launching a preemptive war.
That's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He is the executive director of EPIC, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. He's also a co-founder of Veterans for Common Sense. Eric Gustafson, I want to fire a question about going back to the last caller. In 1991, after Saddam Hussein's troops pulled out of Kuwait, they were massacred. They were retreating armies. The Iraqi army was massacred, and there was the rebel Kurds were pushing in on Baghdad, and they were denied access to seized weapons. Can you talk more briefly about that?
Absolutely. I mean, well over 80% of Iraq was liberated shortly after the 91 war because of a popular uprising that swept across the country. A number of reasons we can go into, the Bush administration, and as well as our allies, it wasn't just the Bush administration, felt that it was too risky, that the social chaos might run out of control. There was, illegitimate fears about a Shiite Muslim population taking control of the country because the majority of Iraqis are Shiite Muslim, about 65%. For a number of other reasons, the Bush administration decided and indeed acted on this, that in negotiating a ceasefire with the Iraqi generals allowed the Iraqi government to be able to have troop movements as long as it stayed within Iraq's borders, to be able to use helicopter gunships and whatever else it needed to be able to crush the uprising. And as a result, tens of thousands of Iraqis that were taking part trying to overthrow their regime were killed. Many more fled the country. It led to one of the worst refugee crises the world has ever seen. I'm sure your listeners will remember the Kurds huddled in the mountains, freezing to death. Mm-hmm. That was the result of that decision. So we actually allowed Iraq, in the ceasefire agreement, to brutally crush the uprising.
And that's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He's joining us by telephone from his office in Washington, D.C., where he is the executive director of EPIC, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. He's also a co-founder of Veterans for Common Sense. Eric, we got a couple of calls lined up, and we're going to take Louie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Louie, you're on the line. Louie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for calling us today. What's your question?
Thank you, Vinny. It's a great show. I have just a comment for Mr. Gustafson and then a recommendation for some actions that people can take. Mr. Gustafson is a vet, and so, of course, he's aware of the severe health consequences that have resulted for the vets who were in the war and who prowled around the destroyed Iraqi tanks after the battles. And the vets were not told, the GIs then, were not told that they had been destroyed with depleted uranium and that the whole tank was radioactive. And so these guys are coming home and their wives are giving birth to children with birth defects, and their cancer rates are way up. And this is a criminal act on the part of the military at the time, not to inform the GIs that there was a real danger in going near these tanks during the battles, shortly, directly after the battles, that they would naturally go there to collect souvenirs, as soldiers do. And they weren't warned away from that. So the treatment of the GIs during the war and the veterans after the war has been abysmal, to the point of criminality, I believe. And this is a story that's not being told, and I just wanted to get that out.
Thanks for your call, Louie.
Can I recommend a couple
quickly,
of actions?
Please. We have a couple calls waiting on
the line. Sure. I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, I heard that Congressman John Conyers called for the impeachment of George Bush. Have you heard this?
That might be the case. I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but that might be the case.
Right. Well, whether it goes anywhere or not, the point is that 100,000 people have signed the vote2impeach.org petition to impeach the president. So I would urge people to take that action, call their Congress member, and talk about impeachment.
I want to actually add something to that.
Thanks for your call, Louie.
It's important, and thanks for that call, Louie. You know, when President Bush campaigned to be president, he did not campaign on a platform of unilateralism, of going it alone, of preemptive war. I mean, we are talking about unprecedented policies, and there are tremendous dangers involved. And yet, as a nation, we have not had an opportunity to adequately debate, discuss, decide upon whether or not this is the best thing for our country. So I think there are tremendous grounds in terms of, a number of voters that are upset about what the president is doing, even those who voted for him. And I know one major donor of the Republican Party, a six-figure donor of the Republican Party, actually took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal some months ago, basically saying that, in supporting that the candidate he supported did not support those kinds of policies, and that he wants his money back and he wants his country back. Those sentiments, I think, are being expressed by more and more Republicans. It's not just Democrats that are coming out against this war.
And that's the voice of Eric Gustafson. He is the executive director of the Education for Peace in Iraq. We have a couple calls. Let's go to Tom in Davenport. Tom.
Hello.
Thanks for your call. What's your comment?
Well, first, his comment about President Bush. When he ran for office, there wasn't a war, and the United States hadn't been attacked, so that's sort of a ridiculous thing to say.
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, so why are we going to war, Tom?
Well, I would say that what's going on now is the war has already started, and everybody's protesting the attack against Iraq like it's in a war. And
we've been at war with Iraq for 12 years, Tom.
Yes,
there's been daily
right.
bombings for over 12 years now.
So
since
now
the Gulf
it's
kind War
of
ended.
Finished. You could call this akin to, say, D-Day, and a whole bunch of people are protesting it like it's a war, but it's just a battle in a long string of things that have been going on. And to call it a preemptive strike, I think, is ridiculous. And the people who have fallen into
when has Iraq attacked us there, Tom? I don't remember any time that Saddam Hussein launched an attack on L.A. or San Francisco.
It doesn't matter. That's
it doesn't
a
matter.
Point.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't because it's an environment that
what,
supports.
What about the rule of law here, Tom?
11th.
What, say that again?
It's an environment that led to the attacks of September 11th. It's like saying you didn't catch those gangs.
Can you back that up with any kind of facts?
I think Tom has a good point. And just yesterday in the New York Times, there was actually a news story about this. This is a fear that's been expressed by a lot of intelligence experts. I know I've had this fear, a number of others who are experts on the region. You know, when you look at Iraq, you don't see any terrorist threat coming from Iraq, period. Look at the hijackers. None of them were Iraqi. Look at the intelligence files and the reports that have come from the administration. Again, nothing. Even the CIA, only because of extreme pressure by the Pentagon, by others in the Bush administration, finally had to produce a report speculating that there might be a connection. But it prefaced every single report on, you know, this idea of any link. It said, quote, based on sources of varying reliability. That is a huge disclaimer, and it's unprecedented on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency to make that kind of a disclaimer to accompany any of its intelligence reports. The reason why? Because there is absolutely no reliable evidence of any connection with terrorism. However, there is a terrorist threat that might come if we attack Iraq, and that's what has been reported over and over again in the news, and many experts believe that by attacking Iraq, we create an environment. You're absolutely right on that, an environment that enrages more people around the world and makes it easier for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations to find recruits.
We got Rachel in Watsonville. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I have a comment about the Bush administration choosing not to take out Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War, but there's been two callers before me that I just wanted to quickly comment. Louis's comments on depleted uranium, there is some of the same birth defects in Gulf War vets that there are in Iraqi kids. There's some of the same birth defects in children of Gulf War vets, and we're seeing that. The last caller made a comment about September 11th, and I do know the climate is much different after September 11th, but let's not forget there is no evidence whatsoever connecting Saddam Hussein or the Iraqi government to what happened on September 11th, none. And we have to remember as well that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are old enemies, and if Saddam Hussein was to hand over weapons to Al-Qaeda, he'd be the first one they'd use those weapons on. They are not friends. And to call it just a battle, what we're about to do in Iraq, it's not just a battle. There was 100,000 Iraqis killed in the Gulf War. 15,000 at least of them were civilians who had nothing to do with the war, and we're going to see a lot more civilian casualties in this so-called battle, as your last caller said. It's not worth a civilian life when we have other options. We need to take them. That's my opinion. But I wanted to comment on the 91, the end of the Gulf War. I saw a really good documentary recently. It's called After the War. It was made by Bill Moyers. Mm-hmm. He was formerly in the Johnson and Kennedy administrations. Bill Moyers makes a lot of documentaries, really good ones. This one, I saw Schwarzkopf interviewed in this video, and he was saying that George Bush had made the decision to pull out when they had Saddam trapped. And Schwarzkopf himself said there was a steel door ready to slam shut. They could have taken Saddam out and his whole guard. And he said that the Bush administration had chosen not to do this. And I'm telling you, I saw Schwarzkopf saying this. He was being interviewed by David Frost after the Gulf War, and he said that it was a compassionate decision on the part of the president not to take out Saddam. I don't believe that. I agree with your guess that it was a strategic decision because they didn't want to see the Kurds or the Shiites win in their rebellion. Despite that, we encouraged them to rise up, knowing full well we were going to pull the rug out from under them, and that's exactly what we did. When we had called on them on radio and our politicians had called on the Kurds and Shiites to rise, which they did, they were gaining ground, they were going to take over, get rid of Saddam, we ended up, after having said that we were going to continue fighting for days, we decided to ground our planes, not fight, pull out, and let Saddam fly his helicopters. And he massacred tens of thousands of people. And you know what Schwarzkopf said about that? He claimed he'd been duped, that he didn't know that Saddam Hussein was going to use these helicopters on these rebels. That's nonsense. Any military planner could have predicted that. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments, Rachel, in Watsonville. We are joined by Eric Gustafson. He's joining us by telephone in Washington, D.C. He's the executive director of EPIC. And we got about 5 minutes left, so I want to wrap up with a few comments and questions about... What are the alternatives to an invasion of Iraq right now, Eric? What is your opinion?
Well, a couple. One, I think, is the continued tough weapons inspections. Without question, they are achieving results. And I encourage folks, if they want to check the record themselves, a very good report is posted at fourthfreedom.org. Again, that's fourthfreedom.org. It's the judging the compliance or grading the compliance of the Iraqi government. And it goes into detail where we're seeing compliance, partial compliance, and non-compliance. And there's only one item of noncompliance, and that is that Iraq did not provide full disclosure in its weapons declaration. Everything else has been full compliance, and only a couple areas have we seen partial compliance. That's unprecedented. We haven't seen that ever before in terms of Iraq. And if we can compel Iraq to disarm without the loss of life, we should do so. Secondly, in terms of Saddam Hussein, think of Milosevic. Milosevic is sitting in a jail cell at The Hague right now. I see no reason why we can't do the same in terms of Saddam Hussein. There are, again, nonviolent alternatives that can bring about a change of government in Iraq without seeing a tremendous loss of life. And finally, I do want to touch on the concern about Gulf War veterans.
Mm-hmm.
The 91 Gulf War was not a clean war. There are only 700,000 of us over there, and yet 164,000 are diagnosed or classified as disabled by the Department of Veteran Affairs. Now, does that sound like a clean war to you? It was not even by the stretch of the imagination, and it wasn't just depleted uranium. There were other environmental hazards, including the destruction of ammunition depots that contain chemical and biological agents, and soldiers were exposed because of the destruction of those facilities. The winds blew south, and as a result, soldiers were exposed. And finally, something that I hope your listeners will do, please visit us on the web. We're at www.epic-usa.org. Again, that's epic-usa.org. They can subscribe to our EPIC alerts. We will be continuing to monitor the situation on a day-to-day basis. And one of the things that I really hope your listeners will do is pick up a telephone and call their senators and their representative. They can reach them at 202-225-3121. If they call their representatives, they should urge them to co-sponsor HJ Res 24. Again, that's House Joint Resolution 24. And for your senators there in California, urge Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer to co-sponsor Feingold's resolution. It's Senate Joint Resolution 9. And what those resolutions do is it calls on the president to answer questions related to these outstanding questions that remain before he decides to launch an attack on Iraq. I think that's the least, that the American people should deserve and our troops deserve, is answers to those outstanding questions.
And that was Eric Gustafson, a Gulf War veteran and expert on U.S. policy toward Iraq. In 1991, Eric Gustafson spent 8 months in Saudi Arabia, where he built buildings, roads, and POW camps. Eric Gustafson has been joining us from his office in Washington, D.C., where he is executive director of EPIC, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. He's also a co-founder of Veterans for Common Sense. Eric, one final thought. Again, could you just quickly give us some contact information for the organizations?
Absolutely. Folks can find EPIC at epic-usa.org. And for the veterans organization, this is thousands of war veterans and retired officers. They can go to veteransforcommonsense.org.